Blog Talk Radio.
Gonna tell you a little bedtime tale, legend it will become. Burgers flying out the door, sail on. 2-for-1, no concern for the future, living for today. Fast food bite on your way, lay it all to waste. The masses are afflicted now. Moo, mad cow, mad cow. Mad cow line dance song.
Hey, Shanghai Nation, welcome to the show here on another Friday. QT and Shanghai with you as normal. And I want to start this show off right away today. It is a special day in the history of pro wrestling. 25 years ago today, September the 4th, 1995, it was the first ever WCW Monday Nitro airing on TNT. And I have someone that is extremely familiar with Monday Nitro. Kevin Sullivan, thank you so much for joining us on our tribute to Nitro.
Well, my pleasure, guys.
Well, my first question for you is, as we know, Nitro aired 25 years ago today from the Mall of America. We've heard the story several times from Eric Bischoff, how he was asked in a meeting unrelated to WCW about getting even with the WWF, and he replied he needed an equal playing field for Monday night, and he was granted that. At what point in time and from where did you learn that Monday Nitro was going to be a reality?
Could you repeat that again? You just broke up. I'm sorry.
Sure. When and from where did you learn that Monday Nitro was going to be a reality once the show was greenlit by the network?
I think I was in Orlando and Eric and Hogan told me.
Now, obviously, Nitro is going up against an established TV show, Monday Night Raw. Of course, the first week they were unopposed, but the plan going forward was to go head-to-head. When you first were told about Nitro, what was going through your mind as far as what the odds might be to be successful?
I knew we were going to beat them right off the bat. And the thing was, it wasn't the first one. I knew we were going to get it. I mean, we beat them in the first quarter hour and never looked back for quite a while. And that was the reason why was Vince had gotten complacent and we had Hogan, we had walked over, we had Ric Flair, we had all these young talent, Steve Austin, Brian Pillman, Sting. We had very good talent that hadn't been exposed on a Monday night show ever. And I knew that if these people saw what these guys could do, we'd be off and running. We were.
We all know that people like Eric Bischoff and Hulk Hogan, Ric Flair, yourself, Sting, they all played a really big part in Nitro's early success. But a lot of fans may not know some of the people behind the scenes that were involved in making Nitro happen. People like Ted Turner, people like Bill Shaw, people like even Jeannie Engel, who worked in the front office, I'm sure had parts that played into the success of Nitro. Who are some of the people that worked behind the scenes that may not get the recognition from the mainstream fans but were vital to success of Nitro?
Jim Barnett. Jim Barnett is the top three smartest guys I've met in the wrestling business. Jim Barnett, Gary Jester, Keith Mitchell in production, And you brought up Janie Ingles, who was very, very valuable. And the whole the list goes on and on and on. And Tony Schiavone, I mean, everybody that was in TBS at the time and TNT really busted their ass, and they did really well. Get that thing up and running. Yeah. I hate to keep people going down the line because I know I'm going to leave somebody out. Nobody should be left out. It was a real team effort.
Absolutely. I know it took a lot of people to get Nitro off and running. The first Nitro aired in Minneapolis at the Mall of America, which made it stand out from any other wrestling show on television, especially on a major network. What do you think the process was getting Nitro into the Mall of America, and why do you think...
Hey, sign guy, can we just stop for a second? This guy is calling.
Sure, go.
Can I put you on hold? Hold on.
Yeah, go right ahead. QT, would you like to read from your book while we wait?
Yes, I will. This is Pat Riley, The Winner Within. This is page 63. Riley's Rules for Triumph.
All right, got you back.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
Not a problem. I was just asking about the Mall of America and what the process was to get WCW into there and why they were interested.
Well, I think Hogan directed them there because Hogan had a restaurant there called Pasta Mania. And it sold all kinds of different pastas. And so... it was also for Hogan to show his clout to the people. He was trying to make these Pasta Manias franchises across the country. And he started in Minneapolis. So that's how we ended up there.
Was a segment on the first Nitro with Hogan promoting Pasta Mania, so that makes a lot of sense. When you saw the actual show from Mall of America, what did you think as far as how it looked coming from that location? Did you think that it was going to set you apart and win viewers that way, or did you think that it was a mistake running it?
I think it was right at one time to do it, but I wouldn't have wanted to do it like at malls all the time. Because you don't just draw wrestling fans. You draw people that aren't wrestling fans that really don't know the product. And us trying to get a product off the ground was not the greatest. But they had done so much. And there was a guy, God bless him, he's passed on now. His name was Zane Breslov. Zane put a lot of effort into that for publicity. So we got not just people that didn't know anything about wrestling, we got wrestling fans to come.
Now, the first few months of Monday Nitro, they had a brand new announced team together. It was Eric Bischoff, Bobby Heenan, and Steve McMichael. Bobby Heenan had done announcing for over a decade at that point. Eric Bischoff had 6 or 7 years of announced experience at that point, but Steve McMichael had never done wrestling announcing before. They plugged him as having won a Chicago-based Emmy Award for broadcasting when he did football broadcasting. He had done a little bit in the wrestling business the previous year for the WWF when they brought in Lawrence Taylor. But he had never been a wrestling announcer for anyone until that first night on TNT. What was it about Steve McMichael that you think landed him that job?
I think think it was that he was a crossover from football, and he had worked for Vince, and he had wrestled in that. Remember when the NFL, when they had that WrestleMania in three different places? He wrestled in that
Battle Royal.
He wrestled, he wrestled in that Battle Royal. So Steve had been exposed to the business. Steve was one of the best guys I ever met, and he was just a blast to work with. And he was a hell of a guy, and a lot of people knocked his ability. I thought he brought a lot to the table, to tell you the truth, because here was a guy that played arguably one of the greatest teams of all times, the Chicago Bears. They only lost one game, and they lost that to the Miami Dolphins. And I mean, they crushed the Patriots in the Super Bowl, and Steve was, you know, all pro, and it just, it worked.
When Steve McMichael came on as an announcer, did they already have plans to transition him into wrestling? Was announcing just a way of introducing him to the fans before he was ready to be in the ring, or did the plan to make him a wrestler come after he'd been on the air for a bit?
I think the plan, I mean, I don't know if there was plans talked with Steve and Eric by themselves, but it kind of blossomed into him transitioning from announcing into wrestling. And Steve was, you know, I've heard a lot of people mock Steve, but hey, Steve looked the part. Unlike, you know, some people today, Steve looked, and Steve was an athlete. And anytime you can get an athlete, not that they all can make it, but Steve was thrown into main event matches with really no business being there, and he held his own pretty well.
Agreed. I thought he was underrated as far as in ring with what he at experience level. One of the things that Nitro was most famous for, and it came on that very first show there from All America, was Lex Luger's shocking arrival back to WCW. He had been with the WWF for the last 3 years, showed up unexpectedly and unannounced to the first Nitro. I know it was something of a secret that they tried to keep so they could have him as a surprise. But at what point in the process did you know he was on his way back, and what did you think of how they presented him on Nitro?
Well, I knew when he was back when Eric decided to bring him back. Eric had told me he had been talking to Lex, and what did I think? So he's just another star. It's great. And he actually got Lex at a discount because Lex wanted to get out of the WWE, or it was WWF at the time, because if you remember, that Lex Express was one of the biggest bombs we've ever had in the business. And it wasn't Lex's fault. I mean, they built him up. He was driving in the bus. They built him up as, you know, Mr. Patriot, the red, white, and blue. He slammed Yokozuna on the aircraft carrier. And then they go to WrestleMania, and he doesn't. They have a non-finish. That killed Luger. That killed Luger. And I think it hurt their business for a long time.
I think you're right there for sure. Now, it's been said in other interviews that a lot of the WCW talent was a little leery of Luger because in his previous stint with the company, he didn't necessarily fit in with a lot of the other wrestlers, and some of them were a little bit leery of him coming back once Nitro got up and going and being put back into the main event spot. As someone that would have seen it from sort of both sides of the coin, so to speak, did you think Luger was going to
and he was bringing, and he was instrumental in bringing Luger back. So no one was going to say anything negative because it would be questioned Sting's ability to see what talent was, and Sting was right. We got him at a very, very discounted rate, and to get Luger at that, it was, you know, I mean, it was unbelievable that Eric got him at that price. So it was really good that we had a main eventer like Luger coming in and didn't disrupt the budget at all.
One of the other more celebrated parts of Nitro was a match between Jushin Liger and Brian Pillman. They had wrestled before for WCW, and they got to work on the first ever Nitro together. You, like you have said on this show before, came up with the cruiserweight idea and instituted the cruiserweight division. Was Pillman and Liger something you sort of pushed for as far as kicking off Nitro?
Absolutely. I mean, you got to realize it was 25 years ago. Jushin Liger was the internet darling. And back then, I was aware of the internet, and not so much the internet, but the dirt sheets. I was aware of them, and I kind of followed them. And I saw, and back then, it's not as mystical as it once was, but, you know, back then there was only New Japan and All Japan, and it was something. They had the choice of the greatest talent, not only in the United States, but around the world. I mean, they brought guys in from Germany. They brought guys in from England. They brought guys in from South Africa. They brought in people in from Mexico, South America. That was the place everybody wanted to go to at the time. Now there's, you know, so many companies there, you know, people flying themselves in, which you and I have talked about. People fly themselves in, you know, and they're working there for nothing. And, you know, it's not what it once was.
Absolutely. Now, on that first Nitro, we had a match, which was, of course, one in a very long series between Sting and Ric Flair. They started the first Monday Nitro. They finished up on the last Monday Nitro in a match against each other. We'd seen Sting and Flair before, but every time they wrestled, it seemed like it was fresh and new at the time. Whose idea was it to have Sting and Flair do a match on the first Nitro?
Mine. I mean, if you remember, the first Clash of the Champions was Sting and Flair. I think, didn't they go 45 minutes?
Yeah.
The time limit. Yeah, he went the time limit. And all I had to do was write their names down, and that threw a house, whether it was on for TV ratings or Baltimore or Dayton, Ohio, or anywhere in North Carolina. If it was in California, they drew. And I don't hear people talking about that too much anymore. That was one of the greatest feuds of all times. I mean, that's up there with Dusty and Terry Funk.
For sure. Yeah, it was a great touch when they did the first and the last Nitro, I think, together. It made for a fitting end when the final one did come. Now, looking back on Nitro, it was groundbreaking in that they had the cruiserweight division, they had the heavyweights in the main event, they had the U.S. and TV title for the mid-card talent, and they also had a wide diversity as far as international talent that came in. They brought in a lot of
independent guys to the roster that hadn't been exposed to TV yet. Looking back on Nitro, what do you think the real legacy of Nitro is going to be to the fans, not only today, 25 years later, but fans 10, 15 years down the road when they look back on Nitro?
It was the first time there was a cruiserweight division. It was the first time the luchadors were ever introduced en masse to the U.S. audience, because I was very aware of the migration from Mexico to the United States. Because when I wrestled, I trained at a all Puerto Rican gym. I was the only Anglo in the gym. There was Victor Rivera, there was Pete Sanchez, Johnny Rods, Ramon Perez, Alex Mendina, Miguel Rivera. I mean, I could go down a host of them. So I understood, you know, that this was a market that wasn't being tapped into. So, and then I brought, you know, there's a correlation of luchadors with masks, and they were completely different than their masks were really colorful. I brought Rey Mysterio in. I mean, I knew Rey was going to be a star the day I saw him. I think he was a 19-year-old kid at the time. I mean, this guy was how old is Rey now?
He, I believe, is like 44, 45.
Okay, so this was 20 years ago, 25 years ago. So he was 20 or 19. So I was right. So, I mean, Rey, I had Conan. A lot of people forget Conan was very instrumental. Conan was a huge star in Mexico. And Conan was part Puerto Rican, part Cuban, and he was a star in Mexico. So he encompassed three of the Hispanic groups. So, I mean, and I never realized how, like when I went to Denver for the first time, I didn't realize when Conan was on the card, the big draw he was. In Denver, you don't tend to think of cold weather climates having big Hispanic population. But in Denver, there was the first time Conan appeared, and I think Rey was on the card too. I think half our audience were Hispanic. So, I mean, that's what it brought. It brought, I guess we were way ahead of our time being all-inclusive.
I think that's probably safe to say, yeah. Well, at this point, my partner QT is with us, and I think he has a few questions, so I'm going to give things over to him for a bit.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Sign Guy. Hello, Kevin.
Hey, QT. How are you, my friend?
Not too bad. Now, Kevin, it has been established that 25 years ago to the day that WCW had their first match in the Mall of America. In your opinion, could WCW have higher TV ratings had you had the internet capabilities of today? Say if you were able to time travel and drop a few supercomputers back then, would that debut have had higher ratings, although the ratings weren't bad that 25 years ago today?
What was the ratings? What were the ratings?
Well,
know?
I'm not sure, but they, if you had a high school report card, I think it was a B+ or A-. Yes.
No,
I think
the number of people.
Think
watched.
Your TV ratings were like a 1.4.
Okay, and then later on, it grew up to be a 4, 5 was a bad night. So, yeah, I mean, could it have helped with the internet? Maybe, but how many different things are there to watch now? How many channels streaming? I mean, I very seldom watch network TV. I can't tell you the last time I've watched network TV. And it was a different time and a different era. And those questions that, you know, going back into time, it's like, well, you go, if you had a chance, would you go back in time and kill Adolf Hitler? If you do things like that, it changes history. So I don't know if people, and the, again, so you got to say that everybody had a computer. 25 years ago, I don't think everybody had a computer, you know what I'm saying? So are you basically asking if everything was equal like today and everybody had computers, would the ratings been higher? Right?
Yeah.
That's what,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they would be higher if everybody had computers, but not many people had computers back then. You know,
that's
personally.
True.
Yeah.
Yes, Kevin, I know what you're saying about time travel and how it may have screwed up events. Do you remember the movie The Philadelphia Experiment, where an aircraft carrier got caught in a wormhole, and suddenly this modern aircraft carrier was in World War II era, and they used two Tomcat supersonic fighters to shoot down two Zeros. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Yes, I do.
Oh, okay. Yes, these two Zeros were attacking a private yacht, but a senator was on board.
Yeah, and the guy on the yacht was a senator. Do you remember that?
He was like, he played the role of a senator or something like that.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Well, Kevin, Eric Bischoff was providing color commentary that inaugural night. How many times had you met Eric Bischoff in person before the match, or had you met him?
Oh, yeah, Eric was the head of WCW. He's president of WCW. I had an office right beside him, yeah.
Oh, okay. Now, did you ever have an interview with him where he asked you questions, Eric Bischoff?
Oh, yeah, we used to talk all the time, every day.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Kevin, the first match in the WCW, and Sangai covered this, featured the wrestler from New Japan Wrestling, Jushin Tiger Liger, and he faced Brian Bryan. And both men appeared to be very close in size, although I give the edge in speed to Thunder Liger. My question is, did you ever wrestle Thunder Liger in Japan?
No. I was a heavyweight, and he was a cruiserweight. He was a junior heavyweight, they called it in Japan. And I got rid of that junior heavyweight. I didn't like the junior. It, to me, it was like, it made people like, it was a stigma, junior heavyweight. You know, but I got the cruiserweight idea from Evander Holyfield was the cruiser heavyweight champion before he was the heavyweight champion, and I did that to Eddie Guerrero. I made Eddie the cruiser champion, and then I made him U.S. champion. I was trying to get rid of that stigma that anybody could work with anybody.
Oh, okay, yes, and the cruiserweight did that. Junior, that the title junior is kind of slightly condescending.
What?
The title junior is slightly condescending. Cruiser sounds like a cruiser in the U.S. Navy.
Right.
A battle cruiser. Okay. Well, Kevin, what do you like? Lion Bryan and Justin Liger, at the 3 minute and 22 second mark of the match, Justin hit a cartwheel kick to Flying Bryan's left ear. In soccer, this would have been the equivalent of a Pele bicycle kick. My question is, why don't we see more cartwheel kicks in the Northwest? All the matches I've been to, they've been very rare. The only one that I can think of is I think I saw Darth Carter do one at La Problemita's. A cartwheel kick.
I have no idea. I have no idea why you don't see it.
Have you yourself, Kevin, been on the end of a Darth Carter cartwheel kick yourself?
Have I said that again?
Have you yourself been on the end of a Darth Carter cartwheel kick?
No, no, no.
Oh, okay.
No.
All right. Well, Kevin, after Flying Brian hit a second rope DDT on Justin Thunder Liger, the end of that match, the inaugural match, was near. About 30 seconds later, Flying Brian executed a flying switch to get the 1-2-3. My question is, to your knowledge, did WCW have a weekly rankings? And if so, did Flying Brian move up a few spots from the WCW preseason rankings? Did they have a preseason ranking?
We didn't have rankings.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's just say in hindsight, say if WCW had a preseason ranking like the NFL, and say if Flying Brian was ranked, I'd say number 12, given this very competitive victory over Justin Thunder Liger, how many spots do you think he would have moved up, say if
Four.
He was ranked 12?
Four. He's only eight. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. All right. Well, Kevin, how much money did Ted Turner pour into WCW to become competitive with Vince McMahon? Didn't Ted Turner own a whole bunch of cattle ranches in the Midwest where a lot of his cows ended up in the top of the line steakhouse, Ruth Chris?
I'm not sure about that. What he does own is the lodge. He's the largest property owner in the United States and has the largest bison herd in the United States. He probably has cattle too.
Yeah, I'd say he paid a lot of money to kind of, in de facto, try to dethrone Vince McMahon. I think he has a lot of cattle ranches like in Kansas and Oklahoma.
Okay, I didn't realize that, but it wouldn't surprise me.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, Kevin, Eric Bischoff was quoted as saying that he sat down and made a list before he met Ted Turner. And WWE is taped. I'm going to be live. Number two, they're targeting a specific demographic. And he said, I'll target a different demographic. Number three on his list, the WWE is animated and cartoonish. I'm going to be very reality-based. My question is, on his second thing that he wrote down, they're targeting a specific demographic. Who was the specific demographic that Vince was targeting?
I have no idea.
Oh, okay. I'm going to say it was probably the teenagers to the 28 crowd. That's what I'm guessing.
Okay, you're targeting people that don't have income to get rid of money.
Yes.
Why would you do that?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
That's not a very good business plan. I think Vince is a very smart guy.
Well, Vince is, yes, but I think he was targeting the late teenagers to 28 crowd. Remember, at that time, I believe George Bush Sr. was president, and things were going along fairly good economically. And I don't think at that time of the WCW debut that we were involved in a regional conflict with our armed forces. So things seemed pretty rosy for the future. Or was it Clinton that was president at the time, 95?
It has to be Clinton because Bush Sr., we're in the Desert War.
Oh, okay. You're right. The Desert War. That was from 91 to about 90. Well, that was over pretty shortly. But yes, you're right. The war in Iraq was over, so that may have had something to do with the demographics. Things seem to have been looking up nationally. Yes. Okay. That's very good. Okay. All right. Well, Kevin, do you believe that Ted Turner and Eric Bischoff took note of Vince's 1994 steroid trial and they sensed a weakness or a stink in the armor of Vince due to the steroid trial, and at that time they decided to strike?
No. No.
Oh, okay.
No. No. It was we got Hogan and we could go head to head because we got the biggest star in pro wrestling. Steroid trial had nothing to do with what we did. And
okay.
Vince was acquitted, if you remember.
That's true, he was. Yes. Okay. Now, when the WCW debuted, what do you know anything about their drug testing policies? Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, they had drug testing policy.
Oh, okay.
If your pee was dirty, you were fined and suspended, and then you had three strikes and you're out.
All right.
It was very strict. It was very strict.
Okay. Well, Kevin, in the second match, you had pitted against Ric Flair. But before the match began, Lex Luger made an appearance. Before the match began, did Lex Luger sign a contract on air with Bischoff? Do you remember him signing a paper contract before the match began?
No, he signed it the day before.
Oh, the day before? Okay.
In Atlanta at the office.
Okay, well, in this match that pitted Ric Flair and Lex Luger, Arn Anderson made an appearance and started throwing punches with Ric Flair. Actually, this was after the match. My question is, if you had a choice yourself to be in a boxing match, who would you rather face, Ric Flair or Arn Anderson?
I think I'd rather face Ric than Arn.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, Kevin, in the main event, Hulk Hogan faced the Big Boss Man from the WWF. He was known as a Big Box Man, but in this match, he was billed as Big Bubba Rogers. Big Bubba had the upper hand for most of the match until Hulk Hogan did his Hulk up from the verge of defeat. Hulk hit a big boot and a leg drop. But right after the match, the Legion of Doom rushed the ring to attack Hogan. Luger himself intervened to help Hogan. Now, Mean Gene then interviewed Luger after this confrontation, and Luger said he had no bones, that he wanted to be with the big man, and he challenged Hogan after this match. One handshake later, and the main event for the next show was set. Do you remember the seminal moment in WCW Nitro history when Luger himself challenged Hulk Hogan for that second week?
I wrote it, so I remember it.
Okay. Well,
all right. Well, Kevin, I know your time is a little bit short today. We told you about 45 minutes, so I will wrap things up with you, but if there's anything you want to say or plug or promote, you got an open floor.
Yeah, I want to plug you guys. I want everybody to listen to you guys. You guys got a great show, and hopefully people will listen to you guys because you're both very knowledgeable about the wrestling business. So thank you for having me, guys.
Our pleasure. Thank you so much. We appreciate it. And hopefully people will check out that first Nitro today in honor of the anniversary.
Okay. Bye.
All right. Goodbye. Taskmaster Kevin Sullivan, ladies and gentlemen, one of the all-time greats, someone that was very, very vital to Monday Night Nitro, not only the first episode, but all the way through. QT, there was a lot going on there at the Mall of America that night. Lots of great action. It was only 1 hour long, that first show. Nitro expanded to 2 hours, then to 3 hours. And that first match was just an hour-long show. QT, what would you say was your favorite moment from the first ever Nitro?
I'm going to say that first match. The first match, Justin Thunder Liger. You know, you can tell that my favorite part of that match was when he hit that cartwheel kick. Yes. You could tell that he had tons of experience in New Japan wrestling. Yes. Although he got the defeat, I think his popularity soared. Yes.
Absolutely. Jushin Thunder Liger, popular to this very day. Just very recently finished up his career, I believe, shortly before the pandemic, I think, was his last match. So Jushin Liger, not only did he have several years under his belt at that point, he went on to wrestle for nearly another quarter century. Even after brain cancer surgery, he had cancer and still went on to have a really, really lengthy run.
How do you think Justin Thunder Liger would have done against Darth Carter at La Problemitas?
He probably would have wiped the mat with him and then stretched him for a while.
Come on. I don't know. 25 years can have a 24 years. Let's say if you go back to 2019, wear and tear on the body. I think Darth Carter, you know, is somewhat a video analysis expert. I think if Justin Thunder Liger had any weak links built up in these 24 years, I think Darth Carter would be like a cobra and attack that weak link, be it maybe a kneecap or an ankle. Yes.
I think Jushin Liger would have caught him on the charge and stretched him. That's what I think. Jushin Liger, an all-time great.
Now, Sanga, you yourself may have now, I know you told me before the broadcast, can you tell our Turnbuckle Turmoil listeners a change in wrestling that was due to take place in Idaho? It's been changed to Friday, has it not? Can you tell our Turnbuckle Turmoil listeners?
Yes. Northwest Pro's next show is now the 25th of September. It was originally the 26th. They moved it to the 25th. So Friday the 25th, you can find Northwest Pro at Curly's Bar in Post Falls, Idaho.
Very good. Very good. All right.
Now, QT, we talked about it a little bit earlier with Kevin, but Hulk Hogan's Pasta Mania played a prominent role on that first Nitro. I believe he only had the one store there in Minneapolis. I don't think he ever got it franchised. Did you yourself ever get a chance to eat at Hulk Hogan's Pasta Mania? And if so, did you have the Hulkaroni and cheese?
You know, if I myself am partial to chicken primavera, which is kind of like a grilled chicken breast that is breaded, and then you have like a marinara sauce, and it's topped marinara sauce. You place these grilled chicken breasts with marinara sauce. You cook the chicken breasts on the grill about, I'd say, 80% of the way through. So you have 20% of it left to be cooked. layer these in a shallow pan, cover them with marinara sauce, plastic wrap, and then foil, and let it steam the rest of that way in, for 20% to let it cook. I'd say that's about another half hour to get that 20%. And then right before serving, you cover these with a fine Gouda cheese or something that is not out of a can, like Parmesan. You don't want to cover it. You want to spend a little bit on this cheese, Gouda, you know, or maybe a high-class, mozzarella, I guess, smoked Gouda. That's my favorite dish. But as for me having that at Pasta Mania, no, I didn't have that. Chicken parm.
That's a shame. I think Hulk Hogan's Pasta Mania probably just a little bit ahead of its time, maybe.
I wonder if you can do a Google search and go back and see what was on the menu at Pasta Mania.
I bet you could. I don't see why not.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right.
Now, we talked with Kevin a little bit ago and mentioned Steve McMichael, who is doing color commentary. He would often bring his dog with him. He had a chihuahua that he would bring to the announce desk, and even though they didn't put a headset on him, I guess he was the unofficial fourth announce team member. What did you think of Steve McMichael's dog whenever he would show up on early Monday Nitros?
Well, my question is if this chihuahua had ever met Matilda the Bulldog. That was my first question.
Very unlikely. I believe Matilda passed away probably before Pepe was around.
Now, did this chihuahua, was he ever a fill-in for the Taco Bell chihuahua? The Taco Bell, to your knowledge?
Not to my knowledge, no.
Oh, okay. Which would you rather research, if he had been a fill-in for the Taco Bell chihuahua, or if was on the menu at Pasta Mania? Which would you rather research?
Pasta Mania.
All right. Will Sign, do you want me to read, this is the debut of Pat Riley's The Winner Within, to fill in a couple minutes before I got to go to work? Or do you want me to save that for next week? Or next Sunday, this coming Sunday, when we have Fisherman's Day.
Go ahead and read some Pat Riley to us.
Well, okay, because I myself don't think we're going to have many pauses in Sunday's Fisherman's Day. You know, Gregor Petrov is on that. Yes.
I do indeed. I invited him.
I'd like to ask Gregor if he uses the carbon fiber pole, carbon fiber.
Well, that's a very relevant question.
Okay. Now, this is from page 83, Riley's Rules for Triumph from the Trenches. First, never demean the time you spend in the trenches. If you pay attention to what you're doing, you can learn an awful lot about how an organization behaves, and that can be very useful later on. Second, use any time when you aren't on center stage to strengthen your powers of perception. Even being on the bench or working around the periphery of the Lakers was like attending a master class in professional basketball. It's strictly attitude that lets you learn. Third, keep reminding yourself that attitude is the mother of luck. When I was named coach, some guy said, well, of course he was at the right place at the right time. And that's probably true. But I also know this. There are millions of middle managers in corporate America scared to death that they are going to be picked off in the next reorganization. They're afraid they haven't been promoted fast enough. Or they're worried they've developed trench stigma because they've been down there so long. These people are unlikely to be lucky. not because they've not advanced fast enough, but because they radiate fear, anxiety, and defeat. Luck is literally all you how you look at it. That would be like me going into the ring against Justin Thunder Liger. I probably won't get promoted.
Well, probably not unless you upset him, but I don't think you're going to upset him.
Well, no, I'd go to great lengths not to upset him. Upset him, yes. All right.
No.
We'll sign up. Yes, I better sign off because I myself have to go to that shoot job.
All right. Well, fans, thank you for joining us for our tribute to WCW Monday Nitro, this being the exact 25th year anniversary of that show, if you can believe it. Hard to believe that it's been that long since Nitro hit the airwaves, but it definitely has. Thank you to Kevin Sullivan for taking time out of his day to be with us to talk a little bit of Monday Nitro. And if you have some wrestling near you, go visit if you feel safe here in the pandemic era to go to a show. Lots of shows resuming action. So find yourself one, get to it. We'll be back Sunday. As QT mentioned, Sports Entertainment's tribute to fishing. Apparently, fishing a very favorite pastime of a lot of sports entertainers. We're going to get into that. We have several people from wrestling that do fishing as well. So it should be a great time. Join us Sunday. 1 week from today, we have the tag team Warhawks with us. So join us then, and we'll talk to you soon.